Here's the tragedy of Sam Bankman-Fried, among many tragedies. He had a great idea, and he had a great vision about where the future is going. Now, Sam won't be a part of that future, but what Sam was saying about the future is going to happen. It'll be other business leaders and other businesses that actually execute the future that Sam saw. And what is the future that Sam saw? A decentralized exchange, a area where you could go and transact and have B2B relationships, C2C relationships, where you can take out transaction costs and you can tokenize things that were previously illiquid, things like real estate or art, as an example. And so when you're thinking about the old world, and let's just characterize the old world as the world of modernity. Modernity really started with the combustion engine. And so whether it was coal-fired or oil or refined oil, gasoline-fired engines, that's really where modernity started, because that's where you were able to use those sources of energy to create electricity, and a result of which you created this modern era that we're now living in. Well, like it or not, the Middle East, the good Lord put a lot of the oil in the ground in the Middle East. You know, the Saudis, like them or dislike them, they have 25% of the world's known oil reserves, and they're one of the richest nations in the world. And Foreign Policy magazine ranks them as the 7th most important country in the world. So this is a country that has 31 million people. It's not super populated by the standards of the world, but because of the natural resources and the strategic location that the Saudi country sits in, it is part of the modern era, the traditional modern era, the centralized era, for that matter. That oil, for the last 100 years, has been sold on centralized exchanges. That oil has been protected by the U.S. government. You know, Franklin Roosevelt signed a treaty with Ibn Saud, S-A-U-D, the founder of Saudi Arabia, 80-plus years ago, and we were going to flag tankers and support the shipments of that oil out of the Persian Gulf or the Arabian Gulf in exchange for that oil being denominated in U.S. dollars. That was a very important landmark for the U.S. because if you want to know why we're the reserve currency, it comes to a couple of factors. One is the most important commodity in the world is denominated in our currency, the U.S. dollar. And secondarily, we have the most powerful military in the world. And so those two things make the dollar the reserve currency and sort of force the dollar into the reserves of all the international banks. And all of these banks have to settle somewhere with the Federal Reserve, and a result of which they're accepting some type of American standardized capital requirements and regulations. So all of this is centralized. And when you think about it from that context, Saudi itself represents, it's almost like an iconic fixture of all that centralization because of the power source that Saudi represents in terms of the oil production. So here you are, you're into the future. The future is silicon, the future is services, the future is digitization. And here comes this 30-year-old wonderkind. He's coming with his bag of wares, and he's going to speak about this future. And the Saudis know that at some point in human civilization, if we're going to keep the planet healthy, we're going to probably have less carbon-based fuels that we're using on the planet. We're going to be migrating more and more to non-carbon-based energy sources. And so, you know, they need to move. They need to adapt. They need to grow. One of the reasons why they are having those conferences over there is they're expanding. They're opening to the ideas of tourism. They're opening the ideas of expatriates coming and living in the country more freely. And here's Sam coming with this new vision, this new idea. It was well received. Had he not been a fraud, I would gather and imagine that he would have raised a ton of money in the region. Now, some people will look at my situation with Sam and they'll lament and they'll want me to play the victim and say, oh, woe is me. I don't see it that way at all. I'm a long-term optimist. I am a risk-taking entrepreneur. I believed in Sam. I took a risk going into business with him. And I got it wrong. That's all that is to me, you know. And the good news for me, where I feel very lucky and blessed, is that his fraud was exposed before my friends in that region of the world made their investments. Sam, I think, made a mistake by talking negatively about CZ in his backyard. He did the same thing in Abu Dhabi. We flew back to the United States. I think this information, those are very small, close-knit communities. I think this information got back to CZ. It upset CZ. And CZ said, okay, you know, if we're not going to be friends or we're not going to be competitive, friendly-ish adversaries, no problem. I still own $500 million worth of your token, known as FTT. The article came out. CZ then tweeted that he was going to hit Sam with a bag of his tokens. He was going to do it in the open marketplace. I'm going to put it in the open marketplace and I'm going to sell it, which caused other sellers to come out and put pressure on the token. And then the real fight started on Twitter, and then the mistake started getting made by Sam and his team. And they said, okay, no problem, we'll buy that back. But ultimately, Sam didn't have the money to buy it back. There was a hole in Sam's balance sheet. The fortress was not a fortress. It was actually a house of cards. And so once the selling started in the FTT token, it was a little bit like the Terra Luna situation we were talking about. The selling is eroding capital, which is eroding balance sheet of FTX, which is forcing more sales, try to make up for and try to catch up with the situation. CZ's putting it in the open marketplace as opposed to doing an off-market transaction, which is making people who own FTT get scared, start selling their FTT token. And I believe CZ. I don't think CZ was trying to put Sam out of business. I think he was trying to brush him back from saying bad things about him. I don't think he realized how weak Sam's balance sheet was or the activity that Sam was doing inside of FTX. And then you could see by Monday, November 7th, there was a problem at FTX. There was a capital hole that was irreparable. We weren't 100% certain of that at that time, but it was. And then they were looking for outside capital. From November 2nd to Monday, November 7th, I am aghast at what's going on, but I'm probably in CZ's camp in the following respect. I'm in the camp of, okay, this is a little harsh that CZ's hitting him with $500 million worth of tokens, but Sam can certainly afford that. This is a brush back pitch in a Major League Baseball game. The pitcher's letting you know that he's going to come after you if you keep it up. And this is not a fatal blow to FTX. It's not a fatal blow to Sam. And this will get resolved eminently. But as every day is passing, I'm feeling less confident of that because of the way the market is acting and the calls that are coming into me. I'm getting a lot of traffic in my inbox, emails, texts, phone calls. What do you know what's going on? I hear Sam is insolvent. I hear Sam is totally fine. I hear CZ didn't realize what he was doing when he hit Sam with that. CZ's going to not put those things up for sale now. He doesn't want to knock Sam out of business. I'm hearing all of this sort of stuff generating in the information slash rumor mill. And frankly, I'm reluctant to call Sam because I think highly of Sam. And I don't want Sam to think I'm one of these, concerned vultures, like circling the potential dead mound of FTX. And so I'm sitting there waiting, frankly, for information to come from Sam. It's not coming. And so I'm like, okay, you know, what the hell's going on?
New developments in the controversy surrounding FTX as CEO Sam Bankman-Fried tweeted this morning saying that a competitor is trying to attack the company with rumors followed by, quote, FTX is fine, assets are fine, end quote. This coming amidst questions about FTX's business practices and solvency following a bombshell report from CoinDesk.
In And then, of course, the tweet from Sam was very bad. Okay, you don't have to read Shakespeare. You remember the line in Shakespeare, "Doubt does protest too much"? The minute you tell somebody we're fine, the assets are fine, that's like saying, yes, I just stopped beating my wife recently. Okay, so when did you last beat her? You know what I mean? You can't say to somebody, I don't beat my wife, because they're like, well, what do you mean? You don't beat your wife. Why are you even bringing that up? You follow what I'm saying? So Douth does protest too much. Once he said he was okay, then I knew we had a problem. Caroline Ellison, for whatever reason, you know, she over-tipped her hand. If you're playing poker, she basically said, okay, I'm good at 22. I'll bid 22 for this. Now, why did she do that? She did that because if she could clear these things at 22, that was going to help Sam's balance sheet. Below 22, that was going to cause Sam an even bigger problem than what Coinbase was suggesting on the second. So I don't know if it was November 5th or 6th. Caroline said, I'll bid 22 for them. And guess what happened? That coin went right to 22. She was obviously trying to buy it at 22. And they were thinning out on their capital. And then the lies really started to unfold because Sam always said that he was never involved with Alameda. But of course he was. And so they were commiserating with each other as to what to do. And he had a shortfall. And so there you were on the 5th, 6th of November, pressure on Alameda, pressure on FTX, balance sheet pressure on FTX. And then Sam and his dad started reaching out to people. And I think that was really the death blow. So when they started calling distressed hedge funds like Apollo and Fortress and, hey, we have an asset liability mismatch and we need some rescue financing, the blood was in the water. Once you do that, you're in trouble because those guys are not beholden to you and they're not loyal to you and there's no confidentiality. They start calling other distressed people and all of a sudden you're creating an even bigger run on the bank. And so that started happening. And people have asked me, are you surprised that they called Apollo or Fortress first before they called you? And I'm actually not surprised about that. And the reason I'm not surprised about that is that I think that Sam felt close to me. And I think Sam was presenting an aura of invincibility to somebody like me. And so it was almost too personal to admit to me that he wasn't invincible, that there was a chink in the armor. You know, and he probably thought, rightly or wrongly, by going to an outside third party that knew less of him, that he could get it done, clear it up, and move it on. You know what I mean? But here's the problem. There was a lot of denialism in what he was doing, and there was a lot of misjudgment in what he was doing. He was in denial about the amount, the magnitude of the problem that he had. It wasn't a $1 billion problem. It was a several-billion-dollar problem. There was no good move at that moment. So Sam's calling these distressed players. The distressed players are calling me to see if I have any inside scoop. But right then and there, there's a virtual negative feedback loop, if you will, happening. And now there's blood in the water. But here's the thing. What we now know, with hindsight being 2010, he was in so much trouble, there was nothing. No call to Apollo, no call to CZ, no call to Fortress that was going to solve the problem or the hole that Sam had dug himself into.
Tracy Wang, Deputy Managing Editor at CoinDesk. Basically, if there was no fraud involved, if Alameda went under, FTX shouldn't really have been impacted if they were completely separate and customer deposits were kind of backed one-to-one. What nobody knew at the time was that Sam had loaned $8 billion worth of customer assets on FTX to Alameda. You couldn't really discern that from just looking at Alameda's balance sheet. And that detail came out later.
And so I was in Sarasota at the Ritz-Carlton, and I was speaking at that event, and I flew back to New York from Florida. When I landed, I got in the car and I called Joe Bank. And I said, Joe, how are things going? I'm hearing some rumblings that you guys are looking for rescue finance. Yes, we are. I said, Joe, what's the straight scoop? Well, Joe said to me, we need about $1 billion. I said, okay, $1 billion is a lot, but it's not ridiculous amounts of money. And if Sam has the balance sheet I think he has, and it's just an asset liability mismatch, and he's got to get liquid on a few things to pay it back, you could probably get that money. That was at 7 o'clock. He is optimistic. You could tell he's tense, he's probably stressed, but he's waxing optimistically on the phone. We're going to resolve this. Everything's going to be fine. At 10 o'clock, I talked to him again, and it became very clear that it wasn't $1 billion. It was north of $4 billion. I said, oh, man, we went from $1 billion of north of $4 billion to something really wrong here. Between the 7 o'clock call and the 10 o'clock call, I think he's frustrated and confused by the numbers. He's explaining to me the discrepancy. I'm confused by the discrepancy. He doesn't have a healthy explanation for it. And I know he realizes now that the entire business is in trouble. I say, you know what, Joe, I'm just going to take a plane ride down there. Why don't we meet face to face? And he said, okay, let's do that. Hung up the phone. I turned to my wife and said, I'm going to go down there because I need to meet these people eyeball to eyeball, face to face. You're not going to pick up what's going on Zoom or a phone call. But if I'm face to face with these people, I can get a sense for the magnitude of the situation. And then I talked to Ryan Miller, the FTX U.S. General Counsel. And he said to me that he thinks that the terms of service were violated and that they moved money from the FTX, you know, accounts into Alameda. And I said, well, I'm going to go down to the Bahamas. Ryan did not want to go with me because he thought that there was unlawful activity that took place and he didn't want to be a part of it. He didn't do anything wrong. And I said, well, I'm not an officer of the company. I'm a partner in the business. And plus, I need to see for myself what the hell happened. So I hung up the phone with him. I booked myself on a 6:55 flight from JFK to the Bahamas. I flew to the Bahamas on Tuesday, November the 8th. I got there around 10 o'clock in the morning. I drove to their offices. These guys are typically probably strolling in late because they work late. But you could feel a cultural deflation in that office. The energy that I saw in that office and the vibrancy that I saw in that office in January of 2022 had dissipated by November of 2022, you know, when the bloom came off the rose and it became clear that they had balance sheet issues and perhaps a lot of the people in the company did not understand the full extent of the balance sheet issues. And again, the fraud perpetrated by Sam was done by a very small group of people. So there was a lot of people in the employment status at FTX that did not know of the magnitude of that fraud perpetration. So you know, there's a lot going on here, you know. And so there's a sadness, there's a disillusionment, there's some denialism. Okay, Amy Wu, who is a terrific person and ran FTX Ventures, she had no idea what was going on. She was at the Solana conference in Portugal. She was trying to reach Sam. He wasn't calling her back. And he said, oh, geez, I must have a problem with Sam. But the truth is, he probably didn't want to implicate her. She wasn't implicated. And so she left the employment of Sam non-implicated, but scarred by the situation and the taint and the association of FTX. There was very few people in the office. There was some security people there. They recognized me. I recognized them. How are you guys doing? Where's Sam? Sam's over at Albany. So I called Romnick Aurora, and Romnick sent his wife to pick me up. I got in the car with Romnick's wife. We drove over to the Albany residences. Sam had two apartments. One was the penthouse, but he had the first floor apartment. He owned that as well. And I go to the first floor apartment. I come through the door. And he was using that almost like an office or auxiliary office or a command center. The psychologist is in the kitchen. They've made themselves cinnamon buns. These young men and women have their laptops out. Sam is in the back, apparently talking to CZ. I say hello to Joe Bankman and some of the young kids that are in the room. It's a group of young, inexperienced people that are overwhelmed by the facts that are unfolding. And the people that are in the know are seeing a collapsing house of cards. I then start conversing with the psychiatrist, Dr. Lerner. We're talking about the situation. He doesn't understand the full magnitude of the situation at that moment, nor do I. We're conversing, but there's a specter of desolation. There's a specter of fear in the room. You can tell that some people are already defeated Okay, it turns out, again, with hindsight, that those people were the ones that were directly involved in the crime. They knew the magnitude of the situation. And again, to perpetuate a crime, you can't have a very large group of people. You have to have a very small group. And so the three, four, five people that were around Sam that moved the money with his approval are the ones that know the thing is over. And then the rest of the people are a bundle of fear and confusion. They really don't understand how this is ending so abruptly, because the image and the aura was that this was a pillar of the cryptocurrency community. This was a person that was enormously wealthy, incredibly well capitalized, and all of that is dissolving on the Bahamian beach. You know, the wave is coming in and washing away something that looked like a very fortified structure, but it was really just a foundation of sand and nonsense. They were discussing the notion that CZ from Binance was going to buy the company, and that they entered into a non-binding agreement with CZ. He was going to buy the company, and he was going to, you know, make everybody whole, and everything was going to be okay. They're waiting for Sam to come out. You had a lot of depressed people in that room. You had a group of people that knew that a fraud had taken place because they perpetrated the fraud. And by and large, you had a larger group of people that really were not aware of the extent that the fraud had taken place. There was a full-on panic going on. No, the place felt imperiled. It definitely felt like the business was either going out of business or it was going to be sold. If you were an optimist, you were like, okay, Forbes magazine and Fortune are telling us how rich he is. He must be rich, and so therefore he's going to successfully sell the business. If you were a pessimist, oh my God, we have a full-on fraud situation here. They're going to be declaring bankruptcy by the end of the week. They're waiting for Sam to tell people the results of his conversations with CZ. Sam declares that about 12 noon, he's going to do a firm-wide internal Zoom call. And so he gets everybody on a Zoom call, and he leads the call by telling people he effed up and he's sorry about all the confusion and that they're going to resolve all this and everyone's going to get themselves paid back and they're going to save the company. But he wants people to know that he had a misunderstanding of where the capital was, and there was sort of a mislabeling of assets is what he was telling people. And so now he's in this dire situation, which he didn't expect to be in, but it's okay, we're well capitalized, we're gonna live to fight another day. I stood over one of the younger people who had a unfolded MacBook listening to Sam on Zoom. He was in the bedroom, I was in the living room, and he was broadcasting live to all of his employees. He was hoping to get this business sold to CZ to save customer accounts and perhaps save jobs and keep volume going at FTX. And he would report back to people as he had more information. He then put out a firm-wide email. That firm-wide email ended up in the press. It more or less described what he said on the firm-wide Zoom. But once the lawyers, the Ryan Millers, the con sons of the situation, who were very honest people, again, in my opinion, were explaining to me exactly what happened, that $7+ billion of money was moved from FTX accounts of individuals, into Sam's personal account known as Alameda. And this was a direct violation of the terms of service, and this was a direct lie to what Sam was saying on Twitter and what Sam had actually given testimony to in the Congress. And so now you had that situation bubbling up. Those guys who were honest guys, they weren't implicated necessarily in the fraud, although they worked for a fraudulent company. They subsequently resigned the next day. One of them was in the room, Khan's son. The other one was not in the room. He was in Brooklyn. You know, he was the FTX US general counsel. And so I talked to all of them, got the lay of the land. I confronted some people there, and then I learned from some of the people I confronted that, yes, there was a violation of the terms of service. To what magnitude? Well, one of the people told me $7.6 billion. And so I was floored by that number, and I said, well, if it's $7.6 billion, there's no way that CZ is going to buy this thing. This is too big of a mess. It seemed very grave. It didn't seem like CZ was going to get that deal done. I think it's important to understand brokerage and a margin account first. So let me talk generically about that. To understand what happens in a brokerage organization, I have an account. Other people have accounts. I make a decision that I want a margin account. So what does that mean? I want the right to borrow money from the brokerage organization, a result of which the brokerage organization will give me money based on the collateral that's in my account. Well, long ago, the Federal Reserve said on stocks, it's 50%. So if I have $100,000 in my account, I can borrow upwards to $100,000. But remember, if my account drops by 10%, I now have $200,000 worth of holdings, and my account drops by 10%, well, my account is actually going down 20. Right? Let's do the math together. I have $100,000 of holdings. I borrow $100,000. It goes down 10, but I've now got $200,000 going down 10, so it's wiping out 20% of my $100,000, right? So my equity's going down, the debt stays constant. And so when that happens, it now forces me to sell down the position because I can only have 100% margin pursuant to my equity. So I have $200,000, $100,000 I've put in the account, $100,000 I borrowed, the account goes down 10%. Now I've got $180,000. The margin desk calls me and says, hello, Anthony, you have $100,000 of borrowings and only $80,000 of equity. You have to sell at least $20,000 to get it back to 80 and 80. Okay, thank you. So you start selling. So you understand, if you understand what I just said, that's very dramatic when there's a leverage unwind because everyone's trying to get out to prevent their equity from going to zero, because that's a very, very important thing. And so in cryptocurrency or Alameda or anyone else, they set up brokerage accounts. They said to people, hey, is it okay if I lend out the cash balances in your account to other people that want to have margin? People will say yes to that. Why will they say yes to that? Well, the brokerage account is allowing someone to borrow the money at 6 and they're charging 3, meaning if I have my money in cash in the brokerage account, I'm going to earn 3% interest. Just it's sitting there. Well, they're lending it out to somebody. They're charging that person 6. They're keeping 3 for themselves. They're giving me 3. Okay, so to understand the system, you have certain people in the brokerage facility that have cash. You have other people in the brokerage facility that want to borrow that cash for themselves. And so you have to, for regulatory purposes, you have to keep certain capital requirements. Okay, so that's to be certain amounts of cash to protect from a big market downturn. And so what FTX said is we have one-to-one cash. What does that mean? Sam is so rich, there's several billion dollars in cash on the balance sheet. So even if we're lending money from a brokerage account that wants to lend money to somebody that wants to borrow the money, there's still a lot of cash underlying the balance sheet. So even if there's a market wreckage, the balance sheet is safe. If anybody wants a withdrawal, they'll be able to get that from the cash associated with the balance sheet. Sam put that in his terms of service. He said, we are one-to-one. Don't worry, you got $100,000 in your account and you want the $100,000. We have $100,000 available to give it to you. It was a lie. So what Sam did was he said, okay, listen, all of the borrowings are going to go to Alameda. Alameda is a customer, but all of the borrowings are going to go to Alameda. Now, no brokerage account would do that. No brokerage account would favor one customer to that extent. Moreover, if that customer goes belly up, it would damage the entire brokerage business. So they always have a diversification to who they're lending to, but not FTX. FTX said, well, we're going to favor Alameda. And Alameda is going to get the benefit of all these borrowings. And oh, by the way, if Alameda's equity goes down and it's below the necessary margin requirement, as I've just described, we're going to make exceptions for Alameda. So let's say we have $200,000 in the account and the account goes down 20. The average customer would be called and say, hey, you have to sell at least $20,000, not Alameda. We're going to let Alameda keep its balance sheet on and its inventory on. Well, Mr. Margin Clerk, they're below the collateral necessary to do that. No, we're okay with that. We're going to treat Sam's personal account differently and more favorably than everybody else in the room. And so there's multiple layers of different fraud that took place here and multiple layers of dishonesty.
David Morse, CoinDesk, these entities can print their own money, essentially. That basically amounts to really extreme leverage, which means that if things go wrong, there's nothing left in the box, to borrow SPF's term. But sometimes there is, I guess, is what I would say to that. The other aspect of it, and Matt Levine has written about this quite extensively, his job as the CEO of FTX, which we've since found out was far from his only job, but his actual job was just to let people buy and sell assets and custody those assets and keep them safe, which he didn't do. But if all you're doing is buying and is helping people buy and sell assets, an exchange makes its money off of transaction fees, basically. You know, you take, if you're Coinbase, you take something crazy like 2 or 3%, because then you're really paying for the security. But you know, whatever it is that FTX takes, that's supposed to be their revenue stream. Obviously, he was not satisfied with that.
Binance was going to acquire FTX. That's when people knew that something must have been wrong. Because if there was a run on the exchange, it's like, oh gosh, everybody takes their money off of FTX because maybe there's just a panic or a run. Unlike a traditional bank, which doesn't keep deposits one-to-one, a crypto exchange like FTX should have kept those deposits one-to-one. And then everybody could have gotten all their money back and then put it back on FTX and continue trading. But what people didn't know at the time was that Alameda's financial situation directly impacted FTX, because Sam took FTX money and gave it to Alameda, which was not allowed. And then Alameda lost all the money.
At 2 o'clock, I went down the block. You know, it's a little square where he is in that condominium structure. And down the block, there was a coffee shop. I walked into the coffee shop. I bought myself a coffee and a fruit parfait, which had some yogurt in it. I looked at my emails. I took a phone call from one of my business partners. Said, this is very bad. I don't think these guys are going to be able to get this deal done with Binance. And a result of which, they're probably going to have to declare bankruptcy. Okay, well, let's wait and see, because we didn't really know. As I was in the coffee shop, I saw Sam and two of his colleagues doing a lap around the square. So they were talking together and they were lapping the square, speaking to each other, and they looked very grave and they looked very upset. I then went back into the apartment. Sam said he had to get on the phone with the lawyers. Could I stay? He wanted to talk to me. I said, I'm very sorry, Sam. I cannot stay. There's a hurricane coming in. I have a big week, including going out to L.A. And so I cannot stay. There's a plane picking me up at 3 p.m., taking me home. I expect to be on that plane. And so I went and did that. I shook hands with him. I didn't get the chance really to talk to Sam. What I would say about my interaction with him on November the 8th is he seemed disassociated. I don't know if you've ever seen the scene in Private Ryan where the guy's arm blows off and now he picks up his arm with his other hand and he's now staring at his arm. There's a feeling of shock and there's now a disassociation, like this can't really be happening to me. You know, when you have some kind of traumatic event happening to you, sometimes you disassociate. You say, oh, this can't be me. You know, this is not the normal course of operating procedure for me. This is not the normal course of my life. He says to me 3 times, I really need to talk to you. I'm glad you came down. I'm a little busy, but I would like to talk to you and explain to you everything that's going on. But we don't get that opportunity. We don't get that opportunity. He is avoiding me, and I end up talking more to his underlings, and I end up talking more to the team psychologist, and I end up talking more to Joe Bankman. It became very clear that Joe Bankman had a better sense for how deep the problem was. Joe Bankman's trying to say, you know, he's, you know, complimenting me, saying, you know, you're a very resilient guy. You've been through a lot of situations, ups and downs, the White House, some volatility in your performance. You know, help us, you know, give us some advice, give some of these young people some advice. And I was talking to some of the young people very positively, but I wasn't totally committed to that positivity because I was getting the fact set from people like Ryan Miller and others about the magnitude of the problem. So I was just
telling people, listen, your career is going to go on. You're going to have a successful career, but you have to be open and honest about what's taking place here so that you can hold your head high. I drove Joe Bankman back to his house. You know, he was stressed. And I will say this as a parent. And I have a lot of respect for Joe Bankman, and I like Joe Bankman. And the anguish that I saw on Joe Bankman's face on November the 8th, as a parent, I had empathy for him. I said, oh my God, you know, I have a 30-year-old son. That my son had misappropriated funds and had a dereliction of duty of this magnitude, I would be heartbroken, because I think we try to teach our kids to do the right thing. You know, my message to my children is, your grandfather worked on a crane for 42 years, hot and cold weather. He gave us our last name clean. He paid his taxes. He paid his parking tickets. He had a great expression, if you can't afford the price of the ticket, don't go to the movies. My father always lived below his means. He was a straight shooter. He wasn't affiliated with any criminality or anything like that. And I have a lot of pride in that. I mean, what do we need to do in our lives that could potentially disgrace your no-no's last name that he gave us in good standing? If you want to call me a dummy for buying Bitcoin at $60,000 and it goes to $17,000, you can call me a dummy, although I'll predict that's a temporary dumminess. You're never going to call me dishonest, okay? We run the business with integrity. We run the business with ethics. And so my heart goes out to Joe Bankman, because if that happened to me, I would be devastated and heartbroken. So I can only imagine how Joe feels. I drove him to Old Fort Bay, where his house was. He got out of the car. We talked a little bit. He was concerned. He was appreciative that I was there. He was concerned about the situation. I'm going to do the best I can to help Sam and save as much customer money as possible. We're really upside down here. He got out of the car. I watched them walk up the driveway of his home. It's windy outside. It's not raining yet. The hurricane is, you know, distant. The recommendation was to take off at 3 o'clock. The rain's really going to start to 11. But, you know, you got to get out of there because they're going to close that airport. Cryptocurrency markets are unpredictable. So are Bahamian hurricanes. I got on the plane and flew home before the hurricane hit. And I said to my wife, there's a huge problem. And I would predict that CZ's not going to buy the company. You know, I was back and forth on it. So I'm just going to be totally kidding. I thought, okay, CZ's buying it. When I heard the $7.6 billion number, I said, okay, there's no way CZ's buying it. Maybe that's the wrong number. Khan's son and the whole legal team had resigned from the organization. And it was announced shortly thereafter on Twitter by CZ, the head of Binance, that the deal couldn't get done. CZ made an announcement that there was no way that he could buy the company. There was too much hair on it, and there was too much misallocations of the accounting. And I texted Sam. I said, get some rest. You're going to need rest so you can think focusedly. He did not respond to me. I called the father, no answer on the father's phone, and then I left it alone.
With a tweet saying he effed up and should have done better, the CEO of crypto exchange FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried, seems to be coming to terms with the dire outlook for his previously market leader firm.
Bankman-Fried is now looking down the barrel of legal, financial, and reputational disaster as the one-time billionaire has seen his wealth evaporate in a matter of days since CoinDesk first reported his balance sheet woes.
Leading to a run on the bank as users panic that their funds could be locked up. Regulators are reported to now be investigating.
I get myself back to New York. By Wednesday, I'm in L.A., and I'm telling people in L.A., I think we have a really big problem. And I think Sam is going to have to admit to this problem. And he does. He declares bankruptcy. And by November the 11th, the declaration of bankruptcy took place.
Crypto exchange FTX has filed for bankruptcy today, with its 30-year-old CEO Sam Bankman-Fried resigning as CEO. Our Ari has more on the story behind this spectacular fall from grace.
30-year-old wunderkind turned billionaire Sam Bankman-Fried announced this morning that he is stepping down as FTX's CEO, and the exchange is filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, amidst mounting questions surrounding its business practices and credibility.
On Friday, I went on CNBC because now I'm involved. I have a pretty high profile. I sold 30% of my business to Sam. The business is not getting sold. It's upside down. They have now stopped redemptions. It's Friday morning. I'm on CNBC Squawk Box being asked by Andrew Sorkin what happened. Very plaintively said, please speak up, speak out, and do the very best they can to recover as many client assets as possible. And of course, I didn't want to call it fraud at that moment because fraud is a legal term. I want to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. It's very, very early in the process, and the facts really haven't been solidified or have unfolded. But something very bad has happened here, and it needs to be addressed immediately. Filing Chapter 11 was not the right decision. It was the only decision. Okay, Sam can live in denial and pretend that there was another way out, but he had such an impaired balance sheet and such destruction and misinformation related to his assets, it would have been impossible to rescue that company. Ray gets in there, and he lets you know that this was probably one of the biggest classic embezzlement situations of all time.
So once it became apparent that there was some wrongdoing, it wasn't just a run on the bank. It wasn't just Alameda making bad trades. There was some type of fraud involved and misuse of customer deposits. The next logical question is just, gosh, who at this company knew? It was a process getting in touch with a lot of people that worked at FTX and narrowing down how was this scheme carried out. Sam couldn't really have pulled it off by himself. Who else at the company was complicit in this? And so that investigation yielded some interesting findings. It revealed that this whole operation was just run by a gang of kids in a penthouse in the Bahamas. There were no adults in the room. People before this thought that FTX was just this well-run exchange. Gosh, they only have 300 people. They must have great employees. I think the entire FTX and FTX US empire was valued at $40 billion. And everybody thought he was a genius whiz kid. But turns out, and this was later apparent in the day one affidavit given by John Ray, who became the new CEO of FTX, the former Enron cleanup guy, was like, this is the worst case of mismanagement and fraud that I've seen in my entire career. And so a follow-on CoinDesk story that we wrote was about his cabal of roommates in the Bahamas showed how Sam really ran his company. He clearly had trust issues. A lot of the people that he put in positions of power weren't necessarily experienced adults that knew how to run an exchange. They were just friends that he had either worked with before or went to college with. They were all relatively young and inexperienced people. The CEO of Alameda, Caroline Ellison, who he previously worked with and also dated, and as well as his co-founder, Gary, that was a college friend of his. And these were people that he trusted, but they weren't necessarily well-equipped to do the job, because it turns out that FTX just didn't have an HR or accounting department, and nobody really knew what was happening with all the money, because Sam and his co-founder Gary and his CTO Nishad could basically put in random numbers and nobody would be able to tell where the money went. There was a social hierarchy at FTX in that Sam had an inner circle of people that he trusted, and these were his former college classmates, former coworkers, and a lot of them were effective altruists, which is this philosophy that Sam was a really strong proponent of. And those people were in his inner circle, and they were pretty much all appointed to some type of executive position at FTX, and they got to live in the $40 million penthouse with him. And there is another side to this, which is, oh gosh, if you are living in the Bahamas, you're away from most of your friends and family, and there is no work-life balance. You work with your coworkers, you live with your coworkers, and I think that's also what Sam preferred. He was kind of a workaholic. He was working all the time. And I think he wanted to surround himself with like-minded people that also felt that way. And that, I think, explains a lot of what went wrong from a corporate governance perspective at FTX, in that there were no external checks, there was no board of directors, there was nobody really in the penthouse that was over 30 years old. So these were clearly like a bunch of kids in the Bahamas that really trusted Sam. I think a lot of his inner circle thought that Sam knew best. And I would be surprised if more than six people knew that something unsavory was going on. It began to paint a picture of red flags that people might have overlooked. And we were able to uncover some details like, oh gosh, FTX's auditing firm has an office in the metaverse. And I don't know of a larger red flag than an auditing firm that has an office in the metaverse, which basically allows you to avoid any jurisdiction. And then just all of these other red flags like, oh, he had a lot of personal relationships with some of his female subordinates. And a lot of the roommates, it got kind of misinterpreted as a polycule. But what I was really trying to hint at was he would have, say, a colleague who is, say, the CTO of FTX. And then the girlfriend would then be put into a position of power at FTX. She then became kind of like the head of marketing and HR. And it was this nepotism where if you were in Sam's inner circle, or if you were dating somebody that was in Sam's inner circle and were living in the penthouse with him, you got kind of preferential treatment and you were put into a position of power. And that was interesting because it highlighted the way that he ran his company, which was not necessarily meritocratic. And it didn't necessarily put the people that were best equipped to handle the job in that position. And it peeled back the layer into, oh gosh, maybe FTX was just incompetent. Maybe he wasn't a whiz kid and all this happened because they didn't know how to run an exchange. And that's the picture that's increasingly becoming clear as the details unraveled.
Everyone was disgusted. There was rampant misappropriation of funds, rampant violation of the terms of service. Now the Bahamian government's involved, money's moving back and forth. You're reading about it as well as I'm reading about it. We don't know who's transferring money from which wallets. The Bahamian government's trying to seize assets. The U.S. is trying to get jurisdiction over the bankruptcy. And Sam is taking to Twitter. And, you know, there's now rantings going on and there's more disassociations. There's a lot of mental health issues here because Sam isn't acting coherently. And then a few weeks goes by. He's giving interviews. He gives a deal book interview. He gives an interview to George Stephanopoulos. He's exhibiting this very high profile, but he's on the wrong side of the argument. And any tough interviewer is giving him a tough time because they're asking really good, well-fortified questions, and he doesn't really have really good answers. And so other than trying to say, oh, it was a mistake and it was mislabeling, I didn't do anything with criminal intent, it becomes very, very clear that it was very sloppy. When you listen to the Andrew Rohr Sorkin interview at Dealbook, you're like, okay, well, at bare minimum, this is criminal negligence, what he did as a CEO of the company. He has a responsibility to keep this ship running accurately and tightly. And so that wasn't happening. And so now you fast forward, and we're in a situation where he's unraveling. He's getting advice from his parents. He's getting advice from the media. Joe finally emails me and says, hey, would you be willing to talk to our PR person? I do talk to the PR person that they've hired. He's a former Bloomberg executive. I get on the phone with the PR person. I say, listen, this is what I know. I don't want you to get in any trouble. I don't want you to do anything untoward. I think Sam has to come forward and tell the truth. He's not prepared to do that. Okay. He is prepared, however, to testify. Maxine Walters is tweeting at him that we want you to testify. He's obviously afraid to come to the United States, so he wants to do it over Zoom. How on God's earth they're letting him do it over Zoom, I do not know. I don't understand that special treatment, but they're going to allow him to do that. And he's preparing his testimony, he's preparing his remarks, and he's arrested on the evening prior to his testimony. He releases that testimony to the press. Reading through that testimony, I read it as a very sad, depressed young man who's struggling with various maladies, including perhaps attention deficit disorder and depression, and doesn't give him a license to do what he did, but there was definitely a manifestation of mental illnesses that were affecting his judgment.